This is Attention Talk Radio, your ADHD information station, part of Attention Talk Network. Its sister stations include Attention Talk Video, your ADHD talk show station, our subscription-based newsletter, Attention Talk News, your ADHD news source. Each media channel can be accessed at their respective URLs, attentiontalkradio.com, attentiontalkvideo.com, and attentiontalknews.com. Keep up with all the media channels on our Facebook page, found at facebook.com/attentiontalkradio.
Welcome to Attention Talk Radio, the show centered around paying attention to attention, with your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper.
Good evening, everybody. This is Attention Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper. We've got a really great show for you tonight, Dopamine, the Reward Neurotransmitter and Its Role in ADHD. With us tonight in our virtual studio is Dr. Kenneth Bloom. Real quickly, tonight is Wednesday, March the 26th in the year 2014 at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A few quick announcements. One, the ADHD Coaches Organization Annual Conference is around the corner, May the 2nd to the 4th in Phoenix, Arizona. For more information on that, go to ADHDcoaches.org. While coaches is in the title of it, it's not just for coaches anymore. We welcome other mental health professionals, teachers, educators, parents, and those with ADHD who are interested in learning about coaching and or meet some coaching. And if you go to the conference, you might find one you like, and you might even hire one. Also, the CHAD conference. The Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder Conference is it's only 6 months away. This year it's going to be in Chicago, Illinois, in November. Typically it's around the 10th, somewhere in that range. For more information on that, go to chadd.org. Also, the Attention Deficit Disorder Association Conference is this summer in July in Orlando, Florida, just up the road. For more information on that, go to add.org. And with that, let's get into the show. Again, tonight in our virtual studio, we have Dr. Kenneth Bloom. And because of some scheduling issues, we had to pre-record this. This is a show that I have to tell you was a particular favorite of mine. I learned an awful lot about this, particularly my first question was one that I had wanted to ask a mental health professional for a long time, and I got an interesting answer. I think you might be surprised. So without any further ado, let's just roll the tape. We hope you enjoy the show. We're here tonight with Dr. Kenneth Bloom, who's currently chairman of the board and CEO of iGene LLC and managing partners, and I always have to make sure I get this, Synapamine, Inc., both located in San Diego, California. He serves as senior scientific advisor for G&G Holistic Addiction Treatment Center in North Miami Beach, and he's a full professor of pharmacology at the University of Texas in San Antonio for 23 years, and is currently a full professor of the Department of Psychiatry and McKnight Brain Institute at the University of Florida College of Medicine in Gainesville. Dr. Bloom holds over 200 patents and has authored and edited 11 books and published over 400 peer-reviewed papers. He coined brain reward cascade and reward deficiency syndrome and is credited as the lead author in the first association of the dopamine D2 receptor gene in severe alcoholism. He's considered by many as the father of psychiatric genetics and served on 9 editorial boards and also the executive editor of the journal Genetics and Genetic Syndromes. Dr. Bloom is an ad hoc reviewer of 400 journals worldwide. And with that, Dr. Bloom, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Jeff.
I am exceptionally excited about this tonight. As an ADHD coach and interviewing experts, I've gotten an amazing opportunity to ask intelligent people like yourself at different topics, and I'm starting to kind of collect the dots. And our topic tonight, the title is Dopamine, the Reward Neurotransmitter and Its Role in ADHD, and I've become very fascinated by this. And as I studied into it, I was reading the paper of yours that you co-authored, The Addictive Brain, All Roads Lead to Dopamine. And I guess I kind of want to kind of jump to the end and ask a question, kind of work our way backwards. And that is many people have addicted behaviors where they're drinking alcohol or maybe nicotine and stuff like that, and they're addicted to it. But it seems to me in your literature, it's almost like people are addicted to dopamine, and those substances increase the level of dopamine. So it's kind of funny. Are they addicted to the drug or are they addicted to dopamine? Can you comment on that?
Yes, Jeff. You're correct in saying that we're really probably addicted more to the idea of dopamine release and to make us feel good. I mean, dopamine is a molecule that increases pleasure states and reduces stress. And you can imagine if you didn't have a pleasure or if you had too much stress, you wouldn't be too much for a hippocampus. Or the drugs, whether it's alcohol, cocaine, marijuana and nicotine and smoking, whether it is gambling, sex addiction, shopaholics, we know now that all of these drugs and behaviors all cause a preferential release of dopamine right up part of the brain that we call the reward center. It's called the accumbens. We know that, so that when you say, are we more addicted really to the dopamine effect, the answer is yes. In fact, we just put a book out together with Joan Boston called Dopamine for Dinner. So that kind of gives you the idea that that's exactly where you are.
Dopamine for Dinner, that's like that. It's interesting because I talked about addicted to dopamine. I was talking about substances, but you talked about sex, I guess, maybe gambling, shopping. Those are addicted behaviors. When a person engages in those, is there also a greater release of dopamine in some people's brain as to reason why they might go do those? In other words, is that kind of a self-medicating behavior?
Absolutely. There's a number of studies looking at using the technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging. Glucose causes a dopamine release. Foods cause dopamine release. Gambling for sure causes dopamine release. Anything thrill-seeking, sex absolutely causes dopamine release. We have a paper that we published in the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs with Mark Gold from the University of Florida, our chairman. We call it Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. In other words, sex, drugs, and music causes dopamine release. So we know that for sure now.
This is just fascinating. So this is what's interesting to me is you've been doing a lot of work in the area of genetics and actually trying to isolate this. And from what I understand from your research, there's actually people that are predisposed to, we'll call it reward deficiency syndrome. In other words, their circuitry such as that they have a lack of it and they're more prone to go seek these types of behavior. Is that accurate?
Yeah, in other words, the concept of reward deficiency syndrome, which became about in 1995, when I was really thinking about, we can't really say that the basic phenotype, I'm using a big word here, but the basic phenotype can't be just alcoholism, and it can't be cocaine addiction, or smoking,
yep.
Or gambling. That there has to be, this is an umbrella term that is based on what we call genetic antecedents. These are genetic variations in the normal gene that leads to either more of what the protein is going to be about, whether that's a receptor or an enzyme, or deficiency. And when at the end of the day, since we know that dopamine is needed to make us feel good, the various genes that are involved all affect the release of dopamine at the neuron. In the reward side, like I said, so that these things all involve what we call reward deficiency syndrome, which is just an umbrella term, and ADHD is just part of that as a subset.
That makes all the sense in the world to me. So I like how you put, because you actually coined the phrase reward deficiency syndrome, right?
Yes, I did in 1995.
And I love that because it cascades that stuff out. So ADD could fall in that umbrella. Another type of addictive behavior is there. That's why I like the title. And by the way, you're really good with titles, Dopamine for Dinner, but All Roads Lead to Dopamine. I want to kind of dial that stuff back is from what I understand, dopamine was an evolutionary thing. In other words, is it it's from what I understand, it's a when there's dopamine in the brain, it's a higher level of intelligence. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Dopamine is very interesting because it's insanely involved in the periphery in motor effects. It's keeping the muscles, the skeletal muscles working correctly. And so it's very involved in motor effects. In the periphery, that's also involved with Parkinson's disease starting from the brain down. But the thing about dopamine is that it has a myriad of effects. And one of the effects that it has, it has to do with cognition. So that if you carry the same gene variant, the dopamine D2 receptor A1 form, you end up with one-third to up to 40% lower dopamine D2 receptors in the brain. And we know now that if you carry that particular variant, your ability to focus and your ability to memorize and have decent memory and to understand and comprehend facts or cognition is actually lower. So dopamine is very tied into, you could say, the word intelligence. I usually use the word cognition, global cognition, and that's very, very important.
So is dopamine is very much involved in the prefrontal cortex that humans have that many other animals don't. So the fact that we do it has actually helped lead to our intelligence and that focus. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, I mean, you've got to remember that dopamine's been around from ages, okay?
Uh-huh.
So it certainly evolves. At certain parts of the brain involved, and remember, there's a whole lot of other transmitters going on.
Yep.
But as I said in the beginning, you think that it doesn't stop at the opioids, it doesn't stop at serotonin. In fact, I had a recent, heavy discussion with somebody that was in Budapest. He was actually a reporter for Psychology Today. And I said to him that, okay, if you could tell me what's next in terms of the dopamine system, what's the next neurotransmitter or substance that's involved, then I'm all for saying that the dopamine leads to something else. But no one yet has found anything after dopamine that we could see that makes sense. So, we're using dopamine as the roads leading to dopamine because that's what we know now. Now, to go back to your idea, what's old and what's new, well, it seems there's some evidence that the DRD2A1 form of that gene, which has low dopamine receptors, is the old form, and the newer form is the normalized DRD2A2 form, which has a normal complement of dopamine receptors. When you look at that, you say, what's that about? But we think it's all about the whole idea of flight and fight, in a sense.
Yep.
That people that need to be in a mode of always being ready to take care of their life, to survive. It's more a survival idea. And that's what we needed to survive throughout the ages, through cavemen all the way up to from the Neanderthals all the way up to where we are today. So it's really an old form. And what happened as we entered into the agricultural world where people started to eat meat and fish, the D2 receptors went up and finally was adaptive. And now we're dealing with the normal, let's say 70% of the population of the United States carry the A2, which is the normal complement for the D2 receptors, but a third potentially carry the D2A1 with low dopamine D2 receptors, and that's sort of the older really version. And according to Darwin, he didn't know about the D2 receptor, but he had something called the sympathetic gene, and he felt that was basically a gene that allowed us to have survival people were not very noble. Those that carried it was not sharing very well, okay? So that's the hunter-gathering and all that stuff. So it's a very interesting story.
Everybody, forgive us there. We just had a little bit of technical difficulty with our system, but we're back. We've been having a great conversation about dopamine. Before we had some technical difficulties, Dr. Bloom, I was trying just to kind of put things in context for our listeners that there's five dopamine receptors, and we're talking about D2, which is dopamine 2, and there's two variants, A and B, A1, which is the older variant, and A2, which is the newer variant and more normalized, is just in a real simple form. Is that, did I represent that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Now, we're going to need to go to a break here in a second, but before we do, can you talk a little, because this is real exciting. You've got some patents and some companies out there, and you're trying to come up with a genetic test so that, that I think that you're hoping to be out in the third quarter of 2014 that we can go in and test for that. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, in other words, even when we talk about reward deficiency syndrome, which we said was a subset of ADHD, there may be some particular genes that go on in ADHD as well. But the whole idea is that this whole field of reward deficiency, which includes ADHD, has to do with what we call polygenic inheritance, which means that it's not just one particular gene, but it's a number of genes. They work in concert. That's what I call the brain reward cascade. They work in concert. Everything from serotonin to endorphins to GABA to all, in a sense, work so that you get just the right amount of dopamine released in the reward center. So what we have done is we mapped the genes and the variations of those genes that lead to risk behavior. So we know the gene to serotonin that causes risk. We know the gene for the dopamine transporter gene causes risk. The serotonin transporter gene causes risk. We know these genes. We know the opioid receptor, which is the risk gene. We know the genes that are involved in metabolism of dopamine, like the catecholamine methyltransferase gene. We know the risk allele, the monoamine oxidase. We know the risk allele. So that what we do is we look at about 9 to 10 genes, and we have actually, earmarked those risk alleles, and we count up these risks. And, for example, let's say we had there's 18, what we know is that there's 18, we call it sites, okay, or alleles, or for females, 17 for males, because females are, XX and males are XY. And what we do is we add up the genes, and if you have all 18 in your female, now you've got 100% risk. Now, we haven't found anybody with 100% risk. So what we do is we count them. If you end up with, let's say, 9 of these alleles, you've got a 50% risk. And then we use the standard risk classification, and we just break it up by a third, a third, a third, and we can determine whether you have low, medium, or high risk. And the idea is that when somebody comes into treatment, whether you see their doctor, they're going to be able to take a risk test so that they can see whether or not you have a high loading genetically for all of the addictive behaviors, including ADHD. So, and we wrote a paper in postgraduate medicine, just came out last month, all about genetic testing for ADHD. And the whole idea of reward deficiency syndrome, it's a paper by Gold et al., and it's in the postgraduate medicine. It's January of 2014. So this starts explaining it, okay?
Excellent, excellent. Well, I tell you what, we're going to go to commercial break, and we come back, and we're going to kind of talk just a little bit about the notion of we can unearth some of this stuff, what it can mean for treatment. So with that, we'll be right back after these messages.
Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio. We are CHAD, the nation's leading nonprofit organization serving the community impacted by ADHD. CHAD and Attention Magazine provide science-based information about ADHD to families, professionals, the media, and the general public. Attention is the only publication in which your paid advertising promotes the mission of leadership, advocacy, research, education, and support for the ADHD community. Interested? Advertise in Attention Magazine and CHAD's website at chadd.org or call 240-487-2314.
If you think you understand attention so well, then why are you struggling so much with it? Attention is as simple as it is complex to understand. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. It's grossly misunderstood. Consider this. Focus on the wrong thing, get the wrong solution. In our new ebook, we'll share 5 key tips and insights on managing ADHD learned from conducting more than 300 interviews with attention experts. Download our ebook today at attentiontalknetwork.com and start understanding and managing your attention today. The average annual cost of attending college starts around $25,000. Students who have ADHD are at high risk of dropping out because they haven't learned the critical skills they need to succeed in school. Protect your investment with an EDGE Foundation coach, specifically trained to help students with ADHD and executive function impairment make the transition from high school to college. Visit edgefoundation.org to learn more.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is TimeTimer.com.
You deserve the best-trained ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. We're here with Dr. Bloom talking about dopamine, the reward neurotransmitter, and its role in ADHD. Before the breaks, we were talking about the fact that dopamine actually might be the drug that we're addicted to, and that some people have a disposition to kind of urge for more of that. And we talked about isolating some of this stuff genetically. Dr. Bloom, by doing this, what's the hope here? If we can begin to isolate this, what could treatment possibly look like if, in fact, we could isolate that and test people in advance and know kind of where they are on the continuum?
Well, you know, we think that there's a lot of benefits. One of the things in terms of addiction and people are going into addiction chemical dependency programs or even behavioral programs, a lot of people, they may have ADHD and, of course, they get very involved with drugs and alcohol and they end up having to get rehabilitation. So mm-hmm. they go into a chemical dependency program. A lot of them are denying the fact that they really got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one of the things, and especially in the younger people, you know, they don't really see this as a major problem. So they may go in because they're forced to go in, or people that go in have problems with their wives or their siblings or whatever, and then they end up going into a chemical dependency program. So, well, it's funny because there's people that go in and they go to the same programs that their mother or father went to generations before. It's just amazing. So you can see that there's a genetic legacy that's going on. So number one, letting people realize that they may have a genetic predisposition can be very helpful in terms of them achieving and seeking treatment, just like any particular genetic disorder. The other important thing is that we could actually look at certain variations in certain reward genes that could tell people whether or not their medication is going to work right, whether the Ritalin is going to work or not work. You know what I mean? But that's what they're going to be on. So you could get you could actually determine what the genes are saying about what would work for you or not. Third important thing is that if we know that when you look at your genetic profile that you have a low dopamine function, because when you add up all the genes, you'll get this risk, we can actually, give you something that was going to raise the activity of dopamine, you know, upregulation, and we can talk about that a little bit. And also, the good news is that eventually we can tell, and we have done this with obesity, we have looked at the genetic profile, and by looking at a particular complex of amino acids and some herbs, we can actually adjust and custom make the therapeutic approach based on your variations in the various genes that we're looking at. So, I mean, there's a lot of benefit to that. One of the biggest benefits in the pain world, because, I mean, take a look at Paul Philosema Hoffman. I mean, the guy was 20 years free, had some pain, a doctor prescribed opioids, and then he's off for a year into the world of heroin, which I did. So if I had a test to say, listen, you can't give you an opioid. I mean, the doctor never should give him an opioid to begin with. But if you had a test that could determine if someone who walks in has an accident and maybe never been addicted to drugs before, and now all of a sudden you put him on an opioid, and he becomes a full-blown addict, and we got the world of pseudo-addiction to handle now. So this genetic test has a multiple benefit in terms of approaching this more scientifically, this whole field more scientifically.
So what I'm hearing is, A, if we could do the test, we know that you have a genetic predisposition for it, number one. Number two, by knowing it, we'd be better know what drugs would work. And furthermore, by knowing the combination, it would allow doctors to kind of dial in the appropriate cocktail of stuff in order to kind of hit, customize it for you, because everybody might be slightly different. And so, to me, that would completely change some treatment of some of this stuff, because we'd actually be getting to the source and not just dealing with the symptoms on the outside.
Right.
Is that an accurate representation?
Right. It's almost like a mirror into your brain. It's helping you figure out exactly what's going on, helping the counselor figure out, helping the coach figure out, helping the person understand it. Helping the clinical, the medical doctors, the nurses. In other words, instead of doing guesswork, we're going to be able to be more objective as to how we look at an individual. It's like if you have a heart problem, or even if you have, say, a predisposition to breast cancer, you're certainly aware that you may be able to figure out what to do about it because it gets out of hand. In the case of ADHD, in the case of drug addiction, we're able to at least understand what's going on and how we could actually do a better job in treating it. It's almost going towards what we call personalized medicine. And this is a new field, and that's all what we're looking at, personalized medicine.
I love that. We need to run to a break again, but before we do, to learn about the progress of these tests and learn more about you, is Snapagenics, is that website the best place for our listeners to go to learn
more? No, that one, not for the test.
Okay.
The best website would be to eventually go into www.dominiondiagnostics.com, dominiondiagnostics.com.
Dominiondiagnostics.com.
Yeah.
With that, we'll be right back after these messages.
Yeah, we're working on going to be fully developed, and like I said, it's going to take us, we think we should have it by the end of the fourth quarter. That's what we're hoping.
That's just 9-10 months away, which is great news. So with that, we'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Attention Talk Radio. We'll return in a moment. Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
You can't go off to school with them, but we can. Visit edgefoundation.org to learn more how an EDGE coach can help your student reach their full potential.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is timetimer.com.
Experience the difference with a top-notch ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
Focus on the wrong thing? Get the wrong solution. Misunderstand attention, and you'll struggle with it. Get 5 key tips and insights on managing ADHD learned from conducting more than 300 interviews with attention experts. Download the ebook today at attentiontalknetwork.com and start managing your attention today.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. We're having a great conversation with Dr. Bloom on dopamine. I'm learning a ton. Beginning of the show, we talked about the nature a little bit of dopamine, and we started talking about genes and testing and treatment as a result of that. Dr. Bloom, I'm kind of curious on anything that you could share. It seems to me that if we can isolate these things and get into kind of personalized medicines in terms of medication, there's still a little bit of awareness, and many mental health professionals refer to metacognition as thinking about thinking. But if a person knew that they had a predisposition to this and actually could kind of notice their behavior gravitating to some of the things that might elicit more kind of dopamine, can you speak to that? What hope is there just in knowing this and just your thoughts in just knowing this information for a person internally to cognitively kind of deal with things a little bit better?
Well, you know, it's a good question. Years ago, Bill Lawyers went out into the American public, and he was looking for, you know, behavioral problems. Of course, he was looking for basically ADHD, and he came to the opinion that that ADHD was really something that needed to be people needed to be helped. And it's very important for America to go forward. He, at that time, talked about that, gee, if we can early diagnose it and have something to treat it, that would be terrific. Where people don't have to be struggling, and using some potent drugs, but do something more natural and more gentle. So in that regard, If people knew at a pretty early age that they may have what we call reward deficiency symptoms and a subset of ADHD, if there was a way that, number one, we could have a better diagnosis than the basically neurological and the personal paper testing, if you had some genetics added to it, that would certainly clarify the diagnosis. We wouldn't be over-diagnosing, or we wouldn't be under-diagnosing. We'll have a better idea. We feel that it's very beneficial to know about this. If you had what we call a one gene, one disease called OGARD, if you had Huntington's disease, maybe people wouldn't want to know about that because there's nothing they could do about it. They're going to die at a pretty terrible death, okay? So maybe say, gee, well, why don't I should I test for that? But in the world of reward deficiency syndrome and ADHD, there is hope, and there's things that could be done to help an individual. And that's what we're going on. We're going on the basis that if we can early diagnosis and we can do something in diet and do something more natural, this is where the synaptogenics comes in, I think that would be very, very important for the world, certainly for America.
There's a lot of times when I'm working with somebody that's got ADHD as a coach, one of the greatest things that we say we can teach is the power of the pause. If we can get them to witness and be aware of themselves and what's going on, then they can kind of catch that maybe that urge to kind of go do something. The second that they notice, they're now in choice. And when they're in choice, they can choose to continue to let that behavior go, or override it, if you will, in an executive function type way to alter that behavior. And some of my, we've had many people on the show talking about this in different forms, and many of my peers preach a lot of, they call it meditation. To me, it's more of an attention exercise where you focus on an object for a period of time and you begin to notice your thoughts wander away and you kind of bring them back as an attention exercise so that as you go about everyday life, you begin to notice your attention, maybe gravitate to something, and then be able to catch it and change the direction of it to your benefit. And it seems to me that if we knew genetically that some people had a predisposition to the reward deficiency syndrome, we could talk to them, we could probably more readily work out groups where people could not only deal with it from a medication perspective, but more cognitively to be really aware of it and be able to just notice it and change their behavior, which to me would be pretty exciting because we'd be kind of covered on both fronts. To your knowledge, have you seen any research or anything done with it in that kind of context?
Well, I know what you're talking about, and also there's cognitive behavior therapy and all that
yep.
stuff. The thing that we're saying is this, that if your brain, okay, is, let's put it this way, not homeostatically dopaminergically normalized, okay, and everything that you try to accomplish is being compromised because you can't get there so fast, because your brain don't allow you to get there, okay? And you got to work harder and harder and harder to do it. I'm not saying you can't do it, because people do it. And the people that may do it, we're not sure where they are genetically. They may be at the lower range
yep.
rather than the higher range.
Yep.
So what we're saying is that in order to have a leveling, a playing field, where everybody's supposedly on the same level, if we put something into the organism, the human,
yep.
okay, that would in a sense produce a dopaminergic balance, and then you began to use cognitive behavior therapy, or you use whatever you use in your coaching, your training, to get
yep.
people to stop and turn around and do something else, they will have an easier time to do it, okay,
yep.
and it would be less stressful. And you may never get there. Now, if you think about, if you're using, we're talking about amino acids that we have developed over 40 years with some herbals that are cytokine-free. If you use this at an early age, nothing more than just a brain vitamin, you may end up negating some of the behaviors that young people have to go through carrying the genetics, and us being RDS victim and actually being an ADHD potential candidate, so that what we're trying to say is that the earlier you could diagnose and the more you could do something to resolve the dopaminergic problem, the low dopaminergic problem, in a natural way, I think the better off you're going to be in the long run. And even if you're at the stage when you're older, okay, you're a teenager or you're an adult, and you're on Ritalin and you want to slowly get off and go on to something else, as long as you can do something to stimulate the dopaminergic system, and it's actually, you know, some other devices that we developed a device that can actually, we feel, and we've got a paper that's just coming out, that could actually, we feel, tie into the brain and do the things that we want to do, activate the dopamine system in a normalized and easier way by combining certain ways of activating the dopaminergic system. I think we'll be better off in the long run, and that's what we're saying. That's what we're saying.
Absolutely. Well, this is real exciting stuff. As we wrap things up, is there any other salient points that you think is worth sharing with our listeners before we pull things to close?
I would say that the main thing is for all the listeners to realize that as science progresses, we get better understanding of what's going on. And I would say that it's a slow process, but we're slowly getting there, and there's a lot of hope, and that people should not get overly frustrated, although that's easy said than done. But there's a lot of hope in a good direction. I think that I know a lot of the listeners have family members or themselves maybe involved with addiction in terms of drugs and alcohol or whatever. And I just wanted to point out that there may be a book that under professionals for sure. The book that we did with Springer, Neuroscience, it's called Springer Neuroscience Griefs. It's a book on the 12 steps. We just put Kenneth Blum in and 12 steps pops out online. And it's a book that we linked the molecular biology and the genetics to each of the 12 steps. And that might be very helpful for people that are listening on the program. That's what I would recommend them taking a look at.
Again, that Springer
Neuroscience Briefs. Yes.
Neuroscience Briefs. Springer Neuroscience Briefs, and you're linking the biology, kind of, if you will, to the 12-step process and kind of like, in a weird sense, maybe validating or saying this is why it is what's there and making that link together, which to me is real exciting.
Right, and it explains why some people have a hard time accepting higher powers, and some of why people accept it more easily, and a harder time going through the 12 steps and those that get to it easier. So it gives you kind of a guide as to what to expect.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Dr. Blum, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been the whole experience of coming to know you and preparing for the show has been very, very enlightening, and I know it will be very rewarding from some of our listeners out there, particularly for some of the other shows that we've done. So thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure.
And with that, we'll wrap this one up. Everybody, catch us next week for another great edition of Attention Talk Radio. Take care.